And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest this week is Susan Crandall, who's published 10 novels, six of which she describes as women's fiction, including The Road Home and Magnolia Sky. She's also published three novels of suspense, including Seeing Red and Pitch Black. And this year, Gallery Books has published her historical novel, Whistling Past the Graveyard, a story about a young runaway white girl named Starla who becomes attached to a black woman named Eula and their uneasy journey through the Jim Crow landscape of Mississippi in the early 1960s. Starla Claudel is the 9-year-old narrator of Whistling Past the Graveyard, and she's a real spitfire. How did her voice first come to you?
Starla came to me while I was actually working on another book. I was writing a suspense novel, and it was giving me trouble. And I'm not sure if Starla was there to tell me that I really needed to be working on something different, or if it was just my way of procrastinating on a project that wasn't going very well. But I started listening to her, and her voice was very, very strong from the beginning. And it's rare that it happens. Normally, when I write a book, I do have it play out in my head, and I hear the characters' dialogue in my head. But she was so specific and started narrating her own story from the beginning that sometimes it made me question, because it flowed very naturally, which is good. But as a writer, you tend to question that. You know, is it too easy? Am I not digging deep enough? Am I not doing enough to develop this character? But she's a very strong character and was from the beginning. She evolved quite a bit. The book evolved as I wrote it because I'm not a big outliner. But once I decided I was using her voice, that eliminated any possibility of other points of view in this book. I tried a few chapters in other points of view, and it was like stumbling over a threshold every time you changed to a different narrator. So Starla is the narrator, and it was a lot of fun to see the world through her, a 9-year-old girl's eyes.
Now, the book is set in 1963 in the summer in Mississippi. Was that setting there with her voice?
The setting came from several aspects. I wanted the 1960s because when this book began, I thought I was going to do a Child in Jeopardy story. And I needed something like pre-Amber Alert, pre-internet pasting of, you know, if a child's missing for 15 minutes, everybody's enacted. And in the 60s, you would, especially in small towns, you would go out on your bicycle for hours and on end, and no one would think anything until the streetlights came on and you weren't home like you were supposed to be. So that was the initial choice of the 60s. And then when I started looking at what I really wanted to do with this story, first of all, I love the South. I love Mississippi. I love the history and the culture. And it was a good excuse to take a road trip for research. But you're always looking for ways to maximize your conflict for your characters. And, you know, with the whole civil rights issues going on at that time and how volatile it was just a natural choice for that book.
Now, you say you love Mississippi, but you're from Indiana. How did your love of Mississippi come to you?
I don't know. Every time I've driven through there, as a child, even on vacation, there's something very attractive about it to me. And I'm a big history buff. I don't know if it's the rich history, you know, the whole Mississippi River thing. I would love to be a farmer, so their agriculture appeals to me. It's very hard to explain, but it's something very visceral.
But what about all the corn in Indiana?
I do love all the corn in Indiana. And in fact, I would love to have a farm. But, you know, to farm and to write, I guess I could write in the winter, but I would have to be a crop farmer because I just think that would be a great way to live.
In your acknowledgments, you admit that you're nothing like Starla, or we're nothing like Starla. And she's also an only child, and you weren't an only child. So what did you do to get inside her head?
I am nothing like Starla, and quite often I would put her in a position and then I would think what I would do, and then I would do the opposite with her. I'm a people pleaser, a rule follower, just couldn't be farther from that. So it took some conscious thought to make sure I was having her act true to her character. Fortunately, or unfortunately for me, I was raised with a redheaded sister who is a firecracker. And so I got to watch firsthand at how they react to things and watch a volatile personality. And for years and years and years, my mother always said, oh, I just don't know where she came from. And then I started hearing stories of her childhood and watching her more closely. And she's quite frisky herself. So, yeah, that apple didn't fall far from the tree. I'm much more like my dad, more laid back and cautious and think things through. My sister's very impulsive.
So she's probably helped you get into fun and trouble.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. You know, there are many times where I wish I could be less inhibited. There's just something so refreshing. And that's what was so fun about writing Starlet, is this character was so reactive and uninhibited and true to her beliefs and her feelings that she would go to any length to protect what she thought was right. And that's what I loved about her. She did a lot of things I would want to do, but I don't know if I'd have the courage to do.
Now, with child protagonists, in order for them to have adventures, and she does have many adventures in the book, you kind of have to have parental absence as
yes.
part of the equation.
Yes.
And she does live with her grandmother. Is it Mamie or Mammy?
Mamie.
Mamie. Mm-hmm. And she lives with her grandmother, Mamie. So where are her parents?
Her mother left when she was 3. Well, she actually left a little before she was 3, but she hadn't seen her since she was 3 years old. Her parents were teen parents and totally ill-equipped for having a child. And Starla's mother wanted to be a famous singer in Nashville, so she finally decided that's where she was going to go. And so she's been out of Starla's life for 6 years and sends birthday cards, and that's about it. But Starla's got a big imagination about what her relationship with her mom is going to be when they're reunited. And her father is working on an oil rig in the Gulf, doing what he thinks is the right thing for his child by providing financial support in the best way he can and leaving her in the care of his mother. She was a good mother to him. He assumes she's a good mother to Starla, but she has a lot of resentment towards Starla and how Starla and her mother ruined Starla's daddy's life. So he's pretty blissfully ignorant of it. And, you know, some of it's willful, some of it's just circumstance. So she is a child in search of maternal love.
Because she and Mamie seem, all they do is lock horns.
Yes. Yes, they do. It's a struggle for control. And Mamie is so afraid of what other people are going to think and that Starla is going to turn out like her, quote, quote, trashy mother, that she rides her very hard. And Starla bristles under that type of restriction and spends a lot of her time figuring out how to get around it to get done what she wants to get done, regardless of the outcome.
And this is a family of secrets. Starla's secrets are kept in a lunchbox.
Yes. Starla's secrets in the lunchbox. The most wonderful thing about writing to me is the things that pop up as I'm in the character mode and writing it. And that lunchbox of Starla's is something that I hadn't planned. But when I started writing that scene, it came forth. And it's her way of connecting with the family she wishes she had and that she dreams that she will have, and has every confidence that her mom's going to, you know, make good on the promise to bring them all to Nashville and live in a big house and reunite the family. Starla's not even aware of all the family secrets that are behind those promises.
She not only has difficulty with her grandmother's authority, she does tend to get in trouble in school, but this is the summertime, and there's a girl in the neighborhood named Prissy Pants. And even though she's given her this horrible name of Prissy Pants, she has a keen sense of justice, and when she gets hurt by the neighborhood bully, she reacts.
Yes, yes. Starla's definitely got a keen sense of justice, and this is probably the only thing she and I have in common, is this balance and the way our fuses get lit when there's unnecessary cruelty and ugliness toward people that are in not a position to defend themselves. And yes, Prissy Pants is the antithesis to Starla. She's, you know, patent leather shoes and all the things Starla's grandmother really wants her to be. But when Prissy Pants is being picked on by the neighborhood bully, Starla springs into action without thought. She's going to defend it because, you know, Prissy's the underdog. And Starla can't stand to have an underdog stepped on.
The only fireworks she's going to get to see on this period is the blood coming out of Jimmy Sellers' nose.
Yes, and that's all she wants, is she wants to see her fireworks on the 4th of July. And unfortunately, Jimmy Sellers and her reaction to him put an end to that.
And things spiral out of control from there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, she makes impetuous decisions that lead to more impetuous decisions that lead her on a road that is sometimes funny, sometimes dangerous and difficult, but it's a road that really takes her to the place where she actually belongs, where she finally has that sense of belonging in the end. But it's a rough trail to get there.
So it kind of starts off when she's grounded for the 4th of July, can't go to the town celebrations.
Yes.
But she's determined to have fun anyway.
Yes, yes. You can't keep Starla down because she's going to figure out a way around whatever obstacle you put in front of her. Once she's grounded, her Mamie went to work at the church booth, so Starla was unsupervised but left with a list of chores to do. Before she started her chores, she really started thinking that, you know, I think I could probably go down and mix in with the kids at the parade. Nobody would notice me there. So she figures if she can recapture some part of her 4th of July, which is her favorite holiday, it'd be better than nothing. So she sneaks around, ends up at the parade, and gets in even more trouble, which sets her on her journey.
Because there's the threat of reform school.
Yes, yes.
Because what today would be analogous to threatening a child with reform school?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. Send them to military school? I don't know. Or just ship them off to jail because... That was Mamie's big threat to her. You know, if you don't conform, if you don't follow the rules, you're going to end up in reform school. Juvenile hall, juvie, as they call it. Yes, now I guess they would take you and put you in a structured home or foster care or something like that. But Starla's behavior gets to the point where she does something that she's pretty sure she's crossed the line. And there is no way that she's not going to end up at reform school. So that's when she decides she starts walking and she just keeps walking.
So she hits the bricks. She's going to go to Nashville. She's going to go find her mom.
Right, because her mom's the only person could ever understand her and fix it.
And she's given a lift pretty quick.
Yes.
An African-American woman stops by in a rickety old pickup truck, but she already has a passenger on board.
She does already have a passenger on board. She has a newborn white baby with her. Of course, this is a time when a lot of families had African-American women who took care of the children and took care of the house. And she just assumes this is from a family who the rest of the family is out at the 4th of July festival. And Eula, the black woman, is taking care of this child. And she thinks thinks nothing of it because it's just the way her world was. She's a little afraid she's going to die of thirst out there, so she does accept the ride, even though she gives it serious thought first because she wants to make sure she doesn't get hauled back to her hometown. But she does accept the ride, and Eula's just one of those wonderful characters that I've missed every day since I finished writing that book.
And she's not a gregarious woman. She's very reserved, and she does not offer much of herself up at all.
She does not. She's had a very difficult life, and she's learned to protect herself by staying inside herself. She's had a lot of loss, a lot of abuse in various forms, mostly from her own family. And it takes her a while to know that she can open up to anybody. And Starla's the one person that manages to get inside and help Eula unlock herself and find her own self-worth.
Now, is it a coincidence that both she and Starla have names that end in L.A.?
It is coincidence, and I don't ever think about it too much until I speak of them aloud in the same sentence. Starla came with her name, and Eula came with her name, which happens occasionally when I write a book. Quite often I have to dig around and figure out, a person's background and what their parents would have named them and what society they're from to pick out a name. But these two characters, and maybe that's why they're so special to me, is because they really stepped into my head much more fully formed than many of the other characters I've ever written.
And you said you were a little bit suspicious of the ease that came.
Yes, 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 I was. As a writer, I think it's really hard to turn off your inner critic and your self-censoring and let yourself really ride a story without analyzing it. And this book, it was joyful every time I sat down to write it. It wasn't work. And, some books can be work. You can spend a lot of time procrastinating with various things. I have a very long list that I use for procrastination. But this book, I looked forward to every day sitting down and writing and seeing where their story was going to go. Because I do character work first. I do very little plotting beforehand. I put them in a situation. I figure out where I'm going to start it. But the rest of the book comes as I write. So it was an adventure for me, too. But it coming seemingly much more easily than other books, you do think, well, am I ignoring my craft here? Am I ignoring the blood, sweat, and tears that's supposed to go into every novel? And so finally, I shut that off and I thought, well, this book is going to be what it's going to be. I was in the process of changing publishers at the time anyhow, and so I was uncontracted for this book. And there's a certain freedom in no expectation that this book could be anything I wanted it to be. It may not sell to a publisher, but once I started on this journey, it was clear to me this book had to be the way it was written. It had to be this 9-year-old girl's immediate point of view. I just finally decided I was going to trust it. I was going to go to the end and see what happened with it. And if it didn't sell, I still had a great time writing it. It's always nice when you put your baby out there and someone else loves it like you love it. And that's the way I feel about this book.
Now, on your website, you have different categories for all the books you've published.
Yes.
And you have women's fiction, and then you have suspense novels. And you list this one under mainstream. Do you think there's a real difference, or you're just doing that for the convenience of readers?
There is a real difference. Women's fiction is one of those things that's a real vague hodgepodge of things. But
half the world, yeah.
Yeah. But they were stories of family and relationships, family drama. There was usually a romantic element in them, but it was a woman's journey through these stories to find her true self. And then I had always had a bit of mystery or suspense threaded through those. And the last three books before this one, I went a little more heavily into the mystery and suspense thread of it. They are still very similar to my women's fiction labeled books. But this book is very different. It's the single point of view, a child narrator. I was a little freaked out when they called it historical fiction on a couple of things, but to me, anything I remember shouldn't be considered history. But I was alive in 1963, and I remember certain aspects of it. And it truly is. It's history. And it is a glimpse of life not as it is now. So I guess it is a little bit of a historical aspect to it.
And while your previous books involved love, and there's a lot of love in this book, it's not romantic love, but both Eula and Starla are trying to understand where love fits in their lives.
Absolutely. These are two people who have suffered an absence of love, and Eula in her formative years also. When that happens to a child, I think you tend to go one way or the other. You know, you become ultra sensitive to other people and caring and giving, which is what happened with Eula. She was cautious about it because she's been burned many times. Or you become very bitter and cynical and distrustful in a very negative way. And, you know, the fact that these two people joined together, I think, made them turn toward the positive when they both could have turned more negative.
And after Eula picks up Starla, they head out to her home, which is out in the country. Eula is married to a man named Wallace, mm-hmm. and he's understandably concerned that his wife has brought home two white children.
Yes.
In 1960s Mississippi.
Absolutely. He's totally freaked out when she shows up with these children, and he understands a little bit about, you know, Eula's past and her attachment to children. So he's suspicious of why she has them in the first place. Now this line's been crossed. He really can't figure out a way to undo it that is going to not cause a hailstorm of trouble. So many of Wallace's choices that he makes in this book are based on the real fear and valid fear of what could happen to African-American people that have white children whose parents did not say, here. So Wallace was a little difficult for me to write. You can't tell about it now because I do have some harsh characters in this book, but writing harsh characters is really hard for me. And to hit a balance with him, he's not like totally a bad man. He's a man of circumstance and a victim of his own culture. And therefore, you know, that colors all of his choices. And he's not always making them for a totally negative reason. But he's frightened, and fear is really his major driving force.
We won't reveal too much more about what happens in that interaction with Eula and Starla and Wallace, but eventually, Baby James is the name of the infant that Eula has. They set back out on the road, and Eula agrees to take Starla up to Nashville.
Yes, Eula's promised to get Starla to her mama because she feels responsible in many ways, and there is no way she's letting this child go back out and travel alone. When Starla takes off, she has absolutely no idea how far Nashville is. I mean, she'd never been anywhere but her hometown, basically. You know, when she finds out that it's several hundred miles away, she's very thankful that Eula's there. And they are totally unprepared for this journey that they're about to embark on. But they're both very creative and inventive. And Eula's bound and determined to keep her promise to get Starla to Nashville. And that's really what drives this whole adventure.
And of course, with a young firecracker white young person and an older African-American person traveling together, it's going to bring in some comparisons to Huckleberry Finn.
It probably is, yes. And the thing that strikes me the most when I was looking at child narrators, I was looking for something to compare how Starla was narrating her story. In my research, Huckleberry Finn was actually as close as I could get to the way she narrated her story. Very immediate, no adult filter whatsoever. So basically, I took myself out from in between Starla and the reader and tried to let Starla tell her story. And she has her misconceptions and her misunderstandings, and hopefully the readers understand that she's misunderstanding. But it's an adventure story, and it's a story that shows how lost people can band together and not be lost anymore. So I guess in many ways it is similar.
And she is young, and she struggles. She attempts to use bigger words that she's heard but not quite come to a grasp with.
Yes, yes, she does. She's got some real zingers in there that were quite fun to work with. Her misconceptions of terms, and she's a bright girl, and she tries to absorb a lot. And then she saves things up that she's going to use to impress her daddy later when he comes home for a visit. And some of these words that she's saving up, she actually does use, and Eula quite often has to explain to her that's not exactly the word that she was looking for.
And she's 9, so she's going to have a great deal of ignorance about a great many things.
Yes.
But she's also a young white woman in the South in the 1960s, and she really has no conception of the African-American experience of that time and place.
Oh, absolutely not. Well, one of the reasons I chose her to be 9 and not any older, she had to be at least 9 because I needed her to be able to function out in the world alone. But by the time we're 12, we begin to be aware of things outside our own little orb. But most children at 9, their world is very compact, and they don't ask a lot of questions about what's going on around them. You know, it is what it is. They don't take the time to look at it and take it apart. So that was what was, you know, so unique about this point of view, and that the world that she lived in, there were rules, and she had been taught them from babyhood, and it's not like she had thought it was right, it was wrong. She'd just never given it a thought. So in traveling with Eula, she discovers that Eula's world is very different from Starla's world as a white child, and it was really fun to have her come to understanding. And, you know, obviously from the start of the story, I mean, she has this tremendous sense of justice, and that's what begins to make her question why things are the way they are.
And while our country has so much more to do in terms of race relations and overcoming racism, it was just amazing. When I drove into work this morning, I saw a couple of women probably in the early 60s out doing their morning power walk. And there was an African-American woman and a Caucasian woman, and contrasted to the circumstances in your book and of our very recent past, where that relationship would have been impossible to display in public.
Right. Absolutely. And I tried to display life as it was. I think it's a mistake to put our own today's sensibilities and try to write a story in the past that conforms to those, because that's not the way the world was. And there's a reason it's not that way anymore. And I think if we don't look at it frankly, then we're bound to repeat the mistakes we've had in the past. And, you know, sooner or later, you know, like now we've gotten to the point where very few of our World War II veterans are still living. And eventually in history, you lose the people that have the firsthand account. And it won't be all that long before we lose the narration of the people who had the segregated South as a personal and intimate experience. And if we don't continue to portray it the way it was, we lose the lessons we've learned over the past 50 years.
So while you did grow up in Indiana, and Indiana has had its problems with the Ku Klux Klan in the past.
Absolutely.
But Indiana is a very different place than Mississippi.
Yes.
So how do you start to wrap your head around that in order to set that scene?
Well, I love history to begin with. So what I tried to do was read as many African-American narratives as I could, were people who had lived through the segregated South. And one of the reasons I never, even when I was considering multiple points of view in this book, I did not ever feel that I could go into Eula's point of view, simply because I only know what her world is from watching it from the outside, which is true of many characters. But I think this is a very specific thing. If you've lived under segregation or any type of oppression like that, where, you know, you're treated differently, it colors everything. And for me, I could portray it through Starla's point of view because I could understand Starla's point of view of what was going on around her. But to get the flavor of how it was for these people to have to live in this situation, I did do a lot of memoirs and historical reading and tried to put it all to good use.
And it's little coincidence, I'm sure, that Starla set out on the 4th of July, her Independence Day.
Actually, it was a coincidence.
Really?
To me. Starla may have had a plan from the beginning. Sometimes I wonder. But yes, it was her Independence Day. And when I first began the book, I, being not a plotter, I wasn't quite sure how independent she was going to end up. So it did all work out. And it was released right before the 4th of July. So what a coincidence.
Perfect timing.
Yes.
I'm sure the publishing company may have thought about that a couple of times.
Yeah, some people think a little deeper than I do on so many things. It's surprising.
Well, do you remember what your 4th of July was like when you were 9 years old?
Oh, absolutely. I love the 4th of July. I picked it. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing like the small town summers and any summer celebration like that with the long days and the never wearing shoes. And I grew up in a small town. It was in Indiana, but still, there's a lot of similarities between small towns. Yeah, it was great.
Now, the book has been out, as we're speaking, about a week and a half.
Yes.
What's the response been so far from the readers?
Oh my gosh, it has been so amazing. Like I said, this is like putting your baby out in the world, and to have so many people embrace it and enjoy the story as much as I'm getting feedback from readers it's just tremendous. I try to not look at a lot of reviews and that type of thing, but reader reviews, I love reading, simply because I'm not asking all for good reviews, because I learn something from all the feedback I get from all my writing. And so I'm a big girl. I can take criticism constructively. But this has been getting such a great reception out in the world. It's what every author dreams of.
Well, and when people enjoy the book, and in the future when you do read it and enjoy the book, what books of yours would you recommend that they go back to in your catalog?
Oh, my goodness. Some of my favorite books. I'm really partial to a book called Magnolia Sky. It was my third novel. It also takes place in Mississippi, surprisingly enough. But there's some characters in that I just adore, and I've never wanted to let go. So I would say that would be a good one to start on for your second book.
And you said you're going to have to get back to work here pretty soon. What do you have going next?
Well, I've just begun work on a novel that takes place in another period of great change in our country, the early 1920s, post-World War I. It deals with three people that are displaced and struggling to find their own place in the world. There was a lot of change in our country in the early 20s. You know, we were switching from agriculture to industrialization, and we had motorized machinery, and we had just gone through our first major war in a long time, and the prejudice that came out of that. So one of my characters is a teenage orphan of German immigrants. Then another is a veteran pilot. He's got a plane, and he's having trouble reassimilating back into the real world after suffering what all went on in World War I. And then we have an 18-year-old debutante whose family has lost their fortune, and she's having trouble. I have a lot of nonconformists. She's having trouble conforming to what, you know, society is expecting of her. So these three are going to team up, and they're going to have a barnstorming act that goes throughout the country. And that's a way we're going to get to look at different aspects of our country as it was. You know, we'll have tycoons and bootleggers and farmers and tent revivals and all kinds of things. But there's going to be experiences and adventures and love and broken hearts and all kinds of things that I'm not quite sure yet because I'm on my first chapter. But it's going to be a lot of fun, I hope.
Yeah, when you say barnstorm, I think of a Waldo Pepper. The
kind of Waldo Pepper-ish, yes. And there were even some really, really popular flying circuses where three or four barnstormers would get together and get a promoter. And some of the acts that they did and the risks they took in these rickety wooden planes, it's reading
about
it.
Windwalking and all that kind of
stuff. Yes, yes. It's just amazed me. And my dad was a private pilot, and he also liked to build his airplanes. So I have a little bit of experience with aviation and plenty of his resources from back then. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be another character-driven book that hopefully will be a really good ride for the readers.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing Whistling Past the Graveyard with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Susan Crandall is the author of Whistling Past the Graveyard, which is published by Gallery Books. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Number one, you must attribute the work to WYPL Radio of Memphis, Tennessee. Number two, you may not use this work for commercial purposes. And number three, no derivative works are allowed. You may not transform, alter, or build upon this work. For any reuse or distribution of this work, you must make clear to others the license terms of the work. Any of the previous conditions can be waived if you get permission from WYPL Radio. And nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.